Hello, and welcome to Beyond the Gates, How Arctic Research Affects You. We are happy to welcome you to episode 8, and I am here with Dr. Jack Kilgore, and he is with the Environmental Laboratory at Arctic and, well, and otherwise known as EL, and we're going to be talking about controlling the spread of invasive carp. Good morning.
Good morning, Annette.
How are you this morning?
I'm just fine, thank you.
Well, great. And I'm so happy to have you here. And we're going to talk about a lot of interesting stuff about some fish and the river. And it's very important stuff to our very important knowledge that you'll be giving everybody. So you're going to be educating everyone about the invasive carp. So what is your role at Arctic?
I am a biologist, actually a research fishery biologist at Arctic. That has been my role ever since I began working at Arctic in the 1980s.
Okay. Well, tell me about yourself and your background, and what steps did you take to get where you are and your relationship with the community?
You know, I heard about Waterways Experiment Station when I was in graduate school, and went to a meeting and met a few people from Waterways, and the next thing you know, I had a job there. And I've been there ever since, really doing kind of the same thing. We conduct environmental research for the Corps. At the beginning, it was trying to figure out how to complete environmental impact statements. NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, was just passed about a decade ago, and the Corps was still trying to figure out, you know, how to do an EIS. And then we had more legislation that provided the Corps an opportunity to do ecosystem restoration. So we started evaluating the ecological benefits of ecosystem restoration on the Mississippi River and tributaries in particular. That's really always been my geographic area of expertise is I call it the MR&T, the Mississippi River and tributaries. And then it became an endangered species, set of endangered species issues with sturgeon. And then finally, more of the recent is the encroachment of the invasive carp. And people wonder, now, why would the Corps of Engineers get involved with these invasive carp? And it's because the Corps manages the waterways. So they essentially manage the dispersal and the movement of these fish from one waterways to another. So they were more or less directly involved, and that's what I have been addressing now for the last probably 15 years of helping the Corps manage the invasive species.
Okay. And then, well, that kind of segues into our next question. So what is the history of invasive carp, and why is the subject important to our listeners?
The carp were actually, we have five species of invasive carp in the United States. The first was the common carp. The common carp were introduced in the late 19th century as a food fish. So at that time, you know, a lot of it was still subsistence fishing, and we needed more biomass out there to feed the masses, I guess you can say. And so they introduced common carp, but lo and behold, over time, common carp became invasive. And they're widespread now. But they do create problems by increasing turbidity and so forth. Well, in the 1970s, the commercial fish farmers found out that they were having major problems with algae in their ponds, so they decided to import another set of invasive carp called silver and bighead. And these fish, they actually eat the plankton out of the water. And so the fish farmers thought, well, that will control the algae, and then my catfish will not be off taste because of that. Well, a flood came, and the carp were washed into the Mississippi River, and they found the Mississippi River to be extremely hospitable.
Really?
It was like a buffet.
Really?
They had everything they wanted because the Mississippi River, I mean, you can't talk about the carp unless you understand the Mississippi, but the Mississippi has a tremendous floodplain, a lot of food, and a lot of water for these fish to feed in. They spawn in flowing water, so the Mississippi has plenty of flowing water.
Yes, it does.
And they have a lot of backwaters where they feed. So they began to explode in abundance and began to move north into the Ohio, into the Tennessee, into the Missouri, and ultimately towards the Great Lakes. And that's when the Corps really started getting involved with the electric barriers and trying to stop those fish from getting into the Great Lakes.
Okay. Well, then you've pretty much said how they got into the local waterway. So how are they destroying the water, and can they be stopped?
Well, it's going to be difficult to stop them. I mean, the old adage is, if you can't beat them, eat them.
I've not heard that.
I think that is probably the way to do it. But unfortunately, Americans really do not have a high opinion of carp. Now, carp are one of the most exploitable fish in the world. If you look at how many people eat them in Asia and in other countries, and even in Europe, carp are a delicacy. But in the United States, they have never gained favorable attention. It's just like, you know, maybe an Easterner think, I'm not going to eat those dirty old catfish. Well, we love catfish, right? But a lot of people don't. Carp are a great source of protein. The meat is white and sweet. They have a lot of intermuscular bones. And there's been several attempts to try to develop commercial utilization of these carp. And there's been some success, but it hasn't reached a point where we've really made an impact on their numbers. So as a result, the carp continue to flourish. And once they get into, for example, an Oxbow Lake, they began to utilize all the plankton, all the food, because the plankton is at the base of the food chain. They utilize that. It's not available to the native fish. And so some of your iconic Mississippi River fish, like paddlefish, also eat plankton. They compete with paddlefish. And so we're finding these small, skinny paddlefish in these backwater lakes where they should be very much more robust. So there's multiple types of impacts these fish can have on our native fishery.
Well, and you know, we talk about catfish. I don't like the way they look. I don't like to be around anybody that catches them, but I like to eat them. So there's a difference.
They've tried to rename the carp, silverfin, there's some other names, you know, so it doesn't have carp in the name.
Right.
And people will eat it and go, that's good. You know, but then they find out it's carp, and they say, I don't know about that.
Well, if you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Dr. Jack Kilgore. He is a research fishery biologist with the Environmental Laboratory at Erdic, and we are talking about controlling the spread of invasive carp. So, are the carp in competition with native fish?
Well, yes. I mean, I gave the example of the paddlefish, but there are other species, too. They compete with the forage base, which are the shad. There's gizzard and threadfin shad. They're the two small fish that most other predatory fish will eat. They compete with the forage base of shad. Other fish, like bigmouth buffalo or planktivores, so there's numerous studies have shown, yes, that they compete for food, but they also compete for space because they become so dense. Nest-spawning fish like largemouth bass and bluegill and crappie, those carp get in there, and then they disrupt the nest behavior and the guarding behavior and drives the adults away, and other fish come in there and eat the eggs and the larvae. So you find out about when carp reach about 50% of the biomass in a backwater lake, you see a major decline in your native fishes, especially your exploitable fish that people want to catch, like bass and bluegill.
Wow. Okay. So this is a very interesting question as far as how far can they travel?
Well, they have traveled all the way from the Mississippi River at Arkansas up to Gavin's Point Dam, which is about 2,500 miles on the Missouri, and they're knocking at the door trying to get above Gavin's Point. They're moving over 1,000 miles on the upper Mississippi River, knocking at the door trying to get in. They've already gone through a lot of the lower locking dams on the upper Miss, and they would be in the Great Lakes, except the Corps has built three electric barriers stopping the fish from going through a navigation channel. So what that allows is that it stops the fish, but it allows the towboats and the barge industry to continue to use that vital link between the Illinois and the Great Lakes, which is the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal. And so that electric barrier is on all the time, and the boats can go through, but it does stop the fish. And the reason we know it stops the fish is that we have been doing research at ERDC for over 10 years, looking at how you operate those barriers in order to maximize their effectiveness. And so the operating parameters that are currently being used on these giant electric barriers in Chicago came from the research that we conducted at ERDC. And that's what's keeping those carp out of the Great Lakes right now.
Wow, they do go a long ways. Okay.
Yes.
So we talked about the different types of species of carp. Did we hit on all of them? And how big do they get? And what all do they eat?
Well, no. I said we had five species. I mentioned the common, the big head, and the silver. Mm-hmm. The silver is the one that jumps, and I'll talk about that in just a minute.
Okay.
But there's another one that has recently come up in the fishery called the black carp. And it's different, though. It eats mollusk and snails. Mm-hmm. And they brought the black carp in to eat a small snail that grew in the catfish ponds that ended up giving these catfish an off-taste flavor. So they brought them in, and just like the silvers and the big heads, they escaped. And now they've established reproductive populations in the Mississippi River, and we're very concerned about that species because there are over 40 species of freshwater mussels in the Mississippi River that are either threatened or endangered.
Wow.
And these are what they call molluscivores, so they have these specialized teeth that they can grab these mussels and chomp and break the shell. And so we're watching that population very closely. Another species that was brought in the 70s, maybe even in the 60s, are grass carp. Grass carp were brought in to control aquatic vegetation. In fact, one of the first jobs I had at Waterways, or ERDC now, was evaluating the use of grass carp to control hydrilla and Eurasian water milfoil, which are two problem aquatic plants that the Corps has to deal with. But they're very effective at eating aquatic vegetation. But if you overstock them, they eat everything.
Wow.
And you have the bass and grass community. You know, the bass fishermen like the grass.
Right.
They don't want all that grass to be eaten up. So it's a controversial thing, too. What they did with grass carp is they made them sterile so they could still go ahead and stock them into some of these reservoirs. But even before then, the diploid, the ones that can reproduce, were already out there. So we have major infestations of all four species of carp now in the Mississippi River.
Wow. Okay.
Another interesting thing about all of it, though, is that it's not only that they're going north, but we're finding, for example, black carp, or particularly in the southern part, they're also moving south, and we're afraid that they're going to move in. In fact, they're already documented into our coastal rivers.
Wow.
Like the Pearl and the Pascagoula. And so, you know, it's not only that they're moving north, they're moving throughout the continental United States almost.
Well, you know, are they dangerous to people?
Yes. I mean, only silvers are dangerous. What they do is we suspect it's an anti-predatory behavior. So when they're startled, the silvers will jump out of the water. And they can jump 10 feet. All of us have been hit multiple times by jumping silver carp.
I laugh, but it's not funny.
It isn't funny.
Yeah.
I mean, at first it was, because I would say, you know, it's the perfect way to fish. You go out there, you open up your ice chest, you drive around in a circle, and they just jump into your ice chest, and you have your meal for the day. And that happens, too. They jump in the boat all the time, but they also jump and hit you. And so we figured out for a while ago, okay, if we go 25 miles an hour, they're going to jump behind us. So we were just cruising around, you know, making sure we always get up at 25 miles an hour if we're around silver carp territory. But one of them all of a sudden came out of the water and hit me in the chest and almost knocked me out of the boat.
Wow.
And I said, okay, 30 miles an hour. And so now 30 miles an hour seems to be the magic
speed
for them. But if you're pulling a skier behind you,
right.
I mean, they're extremely dangerous.
Ooh.
And these people who live on lakes are doing everything they can to try to keep silvers out because it impacts boat traffic and safety.
Well, I live on Eagle Lake, and we were actually out on the boat, on the pontoon boat the other day, and there was one that jumped up. And I was like, I haven't seen one in a while do that. So that was quite interesting
to
see.
Yeah, we were afraid there was going to become infestations in Eagle Lake because of the backwater floods. And they get in there. They get into Eagle Lake. But apparently what's happened is most of them move out as the water drains out of Eagle Lake. That's what we're hoping. Because I don't know if you've seen a lot of them. But if there was an infestation, you would know it.
I've seen a couple of dead ones at the boat landing.
Yeah. So. when you're back there in the summer especially, you'll be in an oxbow lake in the shallow water, and it's almost like a tsunami of jumping carp coming at you.
Wow.
And you just have to hunker down and let that tsunami of carp just pass over the boat. That's how bad it can be in many of these lakes today.
Well, so how fast can they go?
Oh, you know, we've done some swimming studies. You know, as they jump out of the water, they're probably going 30 miles an hour just straight up. They do have burst speeds that allow them to move from one area to another. But basically, especially the silvers, we know more about the silvers than the big heads. The silvers, they're lazy fish. They want to get out of the current. And in fact, during the winter, we're finding them in these deep holes, but only because there's hardly any current there.
Uh-huh.
And that's where they tend to stay. Now, when they're moving for spawning movements, then they'll get into the main channel and they'll be swimming upriver. We've had hoop nets out to catch fish, and they have just filled up with these carp. And we can't even get the net on the boat. There's so many carp in that net.
Oh, wow.
I'm Annette Kirkland. Beyond the Gates continues in a moment. You're listening to News Talk 107.7.
This year, don't just go back to school. Conquer school. Get CableLink's broadband up to 150 meg internet and unlimited data together for under $25 per month. We make it easy to switch. For less than $25 per month, get speeds up to 150 megs and unlimited data for 1 year. Everything wireless in your home connects best with true broadband speeds and no buffering. And now add AMP for the best whole home Wi-Fi experience installed by our technicians for only $7.95 per month. There's no credit check, no money up front, and no deposit. This year, smart starts at home. CableLink's broadband up to 150 meg internet and unlimited data under $25 per month.
This offer will go as fast as summer did. Don't miss out. Get all the speed you need for school. Visit cablelinks.com/connect or email support@cablelinks.com to order now. Some restrictions will apply. Offers expire without notice.
Hi, everyone. Champions of Health here. COVID-19 is still around, and with cases increasing, we would like to remind you to stay vigilant when it comes to health and well-being. Symptoms of the new Omicron subvariant include but are not limited to runny nose, cough, sore throat, fever, headaches, muscle pain, and fatigue. If you are displaying any of these symptoms or have been exposed, please get tested and follow your doctor's guidelines on isolation. Let's keep our germs to ourselves. Project Champions is funded by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Office of Minority Health.
Welcome back to Beyond the Gates. You're listening to News Talk 107.7.
So if you're just tuning in, I am speaking with Dr. Jack Kilgore. He is a research fishery biologist with the Environmental Laboratory at ERDC, and we're talking about controlling the spread of invasive carp. So we are talking about the speed of carp. We're talking about how they can jump. But we also touched on a way that the quarry is using a way to control them or remove the carp. Are there other ways? I know you talked about the electronic barriers. Mm-hmm. Are there other ways that are being used to control the carp?
Yes. Probably the most promising approach that's been used, it was developed by USGS and some of the states in the upper miss, is called mass removal. These are schooling species, so if you see one carp, there are hundreds there. And you can develop a coordinated removal program of multiple boats and nets and corral these fish, and then come in and remove numbers of them and put them into a truck and ship them off somewhere. They're used for various purposes now. One of them is that for crawfish bait, for crawfish
pots. Oh, really? Okay.
Another is that a lot of people on in Maine and in Canada are asking for these carp as bait for their lobster traps because of the menhaden collapse. Well, menhaden haven't collapsed, but the number of menhaden, which is typically what they use in those traps, their numbers have decreased, so they're looking for a substitute. Carp is a substitute. They also use them in turtle farms, and so there's. But if we can get people to eat them, then I think we'll make a really. We could, when we remove mass numbers, we can also be able to use that as food for humans.
Okay.
And so I think more and more work is being done, and eventually that's what will happen. We'll never see the end of carp. It's just like fire ants, you know. You have to learn to live with them, right?
Right, right.
But if we can just reduce their numbers to a point where they're not impacting our native fishes and they're not creating a problem for boaters and so forth, then I think we've made a major accomplishment in the management of those species.
So maybe we just need to have like a carp catching contest or competition and something like that.
Well, for you listeners, if you want to have a good laugh,
okay.
Go to YouTube and look for Carp Rodeo at Bath, Illinois. This has been going on for probably over a decade. But what it is, they've got these crazy people that will dress up in armor with spikes on them even,
what?
Hoping that the carp will fly out of the water and impale themselves on these spikes, which does happen. But the competition is how many carp you can bring back, but all the carp have to be caught while they're jumping or jumping the boat. You can't do it any way else. So it's a crazy way, but they do remove large numbers of carp.
And
it's fun, and it's crazy to watch.
What's the name of it again?
It's a carp rodeo at Bath, B-A-T-H, Illinois. And you'll see it on YouTube. One of my colleagues, Dr. Jan Hoover, would actually, he and another colleague, Stephen George, would go up there and actually measure the carp coming that are being jumped, so they get an idea of what size carp are jumping versus which size carp aren't jumping.
Okay.
And also understanding the some of the population characteristics of these carp. So they were actually using this carp rodeo to gather scientific data to better understand the demographics and population characteristics of carp. So
okay.
It worked out pretty good.
Interesting. Well, and we talked about you can eat them. They're safe to eat.
Yes.
Is it certain ones that we talked about that are safe to eat? And how, what's an example of what you can do with them? How can you eat them? I mean,
you know, I've never mastered the filleting of it, but there are folks that, and it's a YouTube, will show you how to fillet the carp in order to minimize the intermuscular bones. And so you get these big slabs of fillets that then you just put on the grill like any other fish.
Mm-hmm.
Put a little salt and pepper and lemon and whatever, and it's really a very, very good meal.
Does it taste real fishy? I know that's a crazy question.
You know, not really. It's okay. It's not. And that's what I mean. It's just our Americans' negative viewpoint of carp, whereas if you actually taste it and you didn't know it was carp, mm-hmm. you know, you would think it's a flounder or something, you know, or maybe a walleye, you know, which are very good eating fish.
Right.
And so it's... It has a lot of potential to becoming a major food fish. In China, for example, they harvest them faster than they can grow.
Right.
So here in the United States, we'll get silver carp jumping at 30 pounds. Can you imagine a 30-pound missile coming at you at 25 miles an hour?
Right.
Whereas in China, they never get more than a couple of feet because they eat them before they grow any larger than that. But here in the United States, where you have unlimited growth potential, you get giants. Now, the big heads, the big head carp can get over 100 pounds.
Oh, my.
And one female can have well over 1 million eggs. So you can see the reproductive output of a big head. And we've caught them up to 100 pounds. It's a trophy fish. But they don't take bait. You know, you have to snag them, really, or catch them with nets. Because they're planktivores, so they don't take a bait or a hook with a minnow on the end of it.
So So there's, like you say, there's nothing that you can go, oh, okay, I've got this carp bait, and this is going to...
Not really. Okay. It's that a lot of it is snagging, or netting is how you catch them.
So it's more of a sporting, athletic type thing.
Yes. I mean, once you get one on the end of your of a pole, then it's going to be a fight. They are very strong swimmers. I said they're lazy, but they are, when they need to be, they can swim very hard, and they're very strong fish in that respect.
Yeah, I'm really bad about catching gar and stuff like that. My husband always said, "Oh, it's a gar. It's nothing, you know." You put that, you know, don't worry about it. But they're strong too.
Well, you mentioned gar and that, and one of the management techniques that really has a positive flavor to it to me is reintroducing alligator gar. I mentioned some of our iconic megafauna that we have in the Mississippi River. The paddlefish. Well, the alligator gar is another one. They get up over 300 pounds. And so they're our largest freshwater fish in the United States. Now, sturgeon get larger, but sturgeon aren't necessarily, especially the ones that live in the ocean part of their lives, they can get well over 300 pounds, some of them. But alligator gar are iconic. And what happened in the history of alligator gar, it's very sad, that people mistakenly thought that alligator gar was eating all of their sport fish, like bass and bluegill. Mm-hmm. And so they put a reward on their head, and they just about decimated them, thinking that they were impacting their sport fish. And it turns out, after research, that is not true. They mainly eat shad. And now they're trying to introduce them. They're developing. Mississippi Wildlife Fisheries and Parks has a hatchery, or U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has a hatchery up in Tupelo, where they are producing baby alligator gar, reintroducing them into the Mississippi River watershed, not only to restore their historic proportions, but also as a control for the Asian carp. The carp grow so fast mm-hmm. here in the United States that they grow outside the width of the mouths of most predators, except alligator gar. Alligator really? Gar can eat a 5-pound or 6-pound carp, whereas your other catfish usually can't. So, I mean, hopefully by reintroducing alligator gar, we'll also see maybe an impact on their numbers over time.
Okay, but they're not pretty.
No, they're not pretty. They have that heavy armor plate.
Oh, they're not pretty.
But they are just fascinating. I mean, you think about a 300-pound fish in a river eating. I mean, it's and they don't. I mean, a lot of people think, oh my gosh, they're going to attack humans. There's never been a report that an alligator gar have attacked humans. And I tell people that because
it's an intimidating name.
It's an intimidating name, but I mean, there's really nothing in the Mississippi River that's going to attack you. In the right. river proper. Now, there are alligators, and alligators right. are eating the Asian carp. The
I was going to ask that, if they do eat them.
Oh, yeah. They're a mainstay, so alligators will eat them. But as far as fish attacking you while you're on a sandbar on the Mississippi River, you know, over there in Vicksburg, mm-hmm. it's just not going to happen.
Right. Okay. So, what do you want people to remember from this valuable conversation? A lot, right?
Yeah, there's a lot. I think the advent and of invasive carp and how they have affected our environment is probably one of the worst environmental impacts the Mississippi River has suffered ever since the construction of the levees. But even, you know, with the levees, we still have this wonderful floodplain, and that's what sustains these carp. I think another takeaway point is that we need to come up with ways to convince Americans that carp are good to eat, that there's plenty of food, and we can utilize all five species really to provide supplemental food resources for a variety of people, not only in the United States, but maybe also in other countries. Also, that the Corps of Engineers is doing everything they can to cooperate with the resource agencies in trying to manage these fish. I mean, operation of those electric barriers are extremely expensive.
I'm sure.
But it became a point where you have a $5 billion commercial fishery in the Great Lakes versus a $5 billion navigation industry that needs that canal in order to move goods throughout the United States navigation system from the East Coast to the West Coast and so forth. And that's why the electric barrier was essentially put in there, because it accommodates both of those purposes. But we need to get better at developing multi-deterrent type of technology. So it's not just electricity that we're looking at. Mm-hmm. We're looking at sound and bubbles to try to scare them away, as well as using electricity and some sort of a multi-deterrent type of facility. So I see a lot of research coming up along those lines. Mm-hmm. So it's a I think another takeaway point is this resilience of the Mississippi River, and particularly the lower Mississippi River, is that the river and the floodplain is just a tremendous resource that we underappreciate here in the United States. And I have been studying this river for most of my career, and we're still trying to figure out how the ecology really works in this river. And in the face of invasive species and other types of impacts, we're still scratching the surface. But one thing for sure is that that river is almost a reference system for big rivers of the world. I'm saying that is because it's a free-flowing river with an intact floodplain. Most of our rivers have been dammed.
Right.
And they don't have that free-flowing floodplain kind of characteristic. So hopefully that resilience of the Mississippi River will also tamper or reduce some of the impacts that these invasive species have on our native fauna.
Well, I want to thank you for being with me today, Dr. Jack Kilgore. It's been a pleasure learning about how do we control the spread of invasive carp, and I hope you come back and talk with us again.
Well, I appreciate that. I tell you, I have to conclude, though, that ERDEC has been a wonderful place to work. I don't know of any other agency in the federal or state government that has the capability and interdisciplinary capability of ERDEC. Vicksburg is a wonderful, wonderful place for me to live. We've raised our children here, and I've lived here for many years. So I just have to say that I've been very, very fortunate to have a job at ERDEC over these years in order to address all these problems and come up with the solutions that hopefully make a difference. So I appreciate that, Annette.
Thank you, and thank you for what you do for our nation.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so we will come back at you next time for Beyond the Gates, How ERDEC Research Affects You.